Welcome to the latest episode of Your Wealth with Gemma Dell, a podcast series designed to help you create, grow, and protect your wealth.
Hi, and welcome to Your Wealth. I'm Gemma Dale, NAB Trades Director of SMSF and Investor Behaviour. One of the observations I've made regularly about domestic investors is that they're really keen to invest in high growth sectors such as technology, but they really struggle to find high quality companies on the ASX that give them the exposure they're looking for. They look at the performance of the US markets over the last few years, and particularly the NASDAQ, and they really want some of that exposure, particularly as the technology itself is so pervasive in our everyday lives now. But technology is a very wide and diverse sector, and opportunities within it range from global behemoths to tiny startups. So today I'm speaking with Alessandro, we're going to call him Alex, Barbi, from Platinum International Technology Fund. So yes. The portfolio manager of that fund, one of Australia's longest standing technology funds. It's been around since 2000, which is a very interesting year to start a technology fund. Alex, thanks so much for joining me.
Oh, thanks for having me here.
So we'll get started just talking about this tech sector in general. There's so much to discuss. So many of our investors are excited about investing in technology. They see it as a key driver of growth in their portfolios, or they'd like to see it as a key driver of growth in their portfolios. It's not well represented on the ASX or in the domestic economy at all. So how do you suggest that investors get started?
Okay, yeah, you're right. First of all, I would talk about the background a little bit about technology, what it means investing in technology. Technology has become increasingly a part of our daily life. And if we look back at 15, 20 years ago, we can see how technology is having a much bigger impact on our society, our economy, across a multitude of businesses, generating enormous wealth, but causing great disruptions as well. So I always look at two points of major innovations driving the last few decades of strong technology growth. One, miniaturization of transistors, semiconductors, which were key components of electronic goods. You think about your PC, your hardware, your smartphones, how they change over the years. And second, modernization of communication networks, the telephone networks, the Telstra, the wire, the wireless, supporting enormous quantity of data transmission across the network. So, as a consumer, as an investor, think about these two big drivers. They change the picture. They are fueling the digitalization of the economy. Rapid transformation happening across many industries and so on. So going back to your point about Australian Stock Exchange, there aren't many companies listed. You're right, there are some interesting small caps, some less interesting, they failed and so on.
But not so
the fact is that we have an excellent level of R&D in these local universities. Mm. We have inventions, we have the Wi-Fi patents. We have a company like Atlassian in collaboration software, which was an amazing case, but it went and listed in the US. Mm. So it is difficult to invest locally. So if you want to have exposure to these global trends, you probably have to invest overseas, and either through direct shares or through a sector fund, I would say. I suggest that if you do invest directly, you do have to have a real understanding of the business you invest in. You have to invest in a company you understand. If normally due diligence is required to invest in shares directly, in this case, you probably need double care, I would say.
So you make a really good point. I think most investors are familiar with the FANG stocks, and I think one of the reasons that people feel comfortable investing with those is that they use the technology themselves, right? They're very familiar brands. You have an Apple in your pocket. That Apple has Facebook on it. You Google everything all the time. It's become a verb. You know, so these stocks are familiar brands and things you use every day, more so than the familiar brands like Ford 20 years ago or 50 years ago. Can you talk through those names and your thoughts on them? Partly because with our investors, when they think technology, that's sort of where they start.
Yeah, the FANG, so-called FANG, is an acronym used to identify four highly successful tech companies. I mean, Facebook, Amazon, Netflix, Google. Sometimes you hear about FANG with a double A to include also Apple, as you mentioned, but there are different interpretations of these
I've also heard double N for NVIDIA. That's
yes,
the other one.
Correct,
yeah.
Correct.
It's becoming a really long fang.
Yeah, but in general, they are technology mega caps representative of the last decade of the tech bull market. Huge market capitalization, high valuations, seemingly unstoppable.
Yeah.
But in fact, not all the FANGs are created equal, we say. They do have differences in terms of growth profile, profitability, and business models. So quickly, we can go through the four majors, like Facebook, which everybody is familiar with. 500 billion market capitalization, 56 billion revenues, the most successful social network on the planet. 2.2 billion monthly active users, of which 1.4 billion are considered to be daily active users on the core app. In addition, apart from the core application, Facebook also launched or acquired other applications like Instagram, like Messenger, WhatsApp, all reporting hundreds of millions of users in a constant effort to defend the core business, which is digital advertising, from the threats of new emerging competitors.
Mm.
So revenue are growing at 50% per annum over the last 5 years, and Facebook has been able to navigate through some difficult transitions. First, the transition from desktop to mobile. Then more recently, everybody has been aware of that, the Cambridge Analytica scandal with all these regulatory consequences. And this is probably the most challenging period for Facebook so far. However, we believe that even after the regulatory tightening, the incumbent, the large players like Facebook and to some extent Google, will get out stronger out of this, because the smaller players will struggle to carry the burden of regulation, we think. So Facebook has very dynamic management team, constantly looking for new ways of increasing audience engagement and monetization around the key application. So the valuation in this case, if an individual investor want to buy this stock, would have to pay 26 times non-GAAP PE, which is, if you want, reasonable, not cheap, it's not a bargain, it's not a crazy valuation, but it's a reasonable value for the growth expected. So the second stock I would talk about, Google, the G in the FANG, is similar to Facebook. It's 800 billion market capitalization, revenue 135 billion, operating in the same digital advertising space as Facebook, is often considered a fierce rival to Facebook. Also, Google is more reliant on search and consumer intent, while Facebook is relying more on display advertising through your application. Google has had a remarkable, consistent revenue growth, despite its size. Currently, it's growing at 23% per annum. And it's benefiting from the ongoing transition from traditional media like print, TV, magazine, to the new media, online, streaming, smartphone watching, and so on. So if you look at Google, it's not only the core search, the revenue driver, but it's also other interesting businesses. They do have, for example, Maps, YouTube. They're all largely under-monetized, but they're growing very fast. Also, not many people would know probably, but the majority of the smartphones in the market, apart from Apple, are powered by an operating system, Android, which was invented by Google again. And then they are expanding in the cloud business, offering software as a service to small, medium businesses and enterprises. Plus, we have very interesting initiatives in artificial intelligence, in self-driving cars. They launched Waymo, these famously self-driving cars in Phoenix, Arizona, and even more futuristic projects. So all this you buy for 26 times non-GAAP PE again. So funny enough, the same valuation as
my
sports book.
Convenient.
So they do face some regulatory headwinds, obviously. Antitrust, privacy again on data, similar to Facebook, as you would expect from such a dominant company in a specific field. Then going to the A in the FANG, Amazon. Amazon is another giant, 850 billion market cap and 235 billion estimated revenues. This is an amazing company, e-commerce pioneer, driven by the visionary Jeff Bezos. Which has expanded exponentially the company from the original collection of books, warehouses.
Selling books,
think.
It seems incredible.
Yeah, it's amazing. And over the years, he expanded dramatically the range of merchandise being offered. You started with the compact disc and then apparel and then you name it, groceries. He has entered in completely new markets. I mean, last year he bought Whole Food in the organic food distribution. He developed Prime Services, which is a subscription service offering free delivery, which has helped to create a loyal customer base. Then it's actually interesting what Jeff did. He built the very first cloud service business available to external users called AWS. Mm. And that's amazing considering that they were not an IT company. They were a distribution, a warehouse, and retailing. And they went and offered this ability to corporates to use Amazon Web Services instead of their own in-house infrastructure, IT infrastructure. More recently, Amazon has accelerated its geographic expansion. It's gone overseas, in India, in Europe, and they develop an internal advertising platform for Amazon third-party vendors. And they even recently, just a few weeks ago, acquired an online pharmacy, a drug delivery services called PillPack. Mm. So they're aiming to really disrupt many industries. Amazon is
everything.
Yeah, is a quintessential disruptor. And the most remarkable thing is that they've been able to disrupt both traditional industries like grocery retail and IT services with software, and they themselves not being an IT company. So again, strong growth, revenues growing organically by 26%. Valuation a bit expensive, they're trading at more than 100 times PE. So on the next 12 months, this is not a stock for a value investor, definitely.
Yeah, yeah. No, not
but an interesting business model. Mm. The N in the FANG is Netflix. Mm. Netflix is a much smaller, relatively speaking, company, capitalized at 180 billion. Mm. Revenues are about 16 billion. So obviously, Australians now familiar with Netflix is taking on like fire everywhere around the world. There are 130 million subscribers to its streaming services, and they're growing at 26%. But they're still burning cash. They're burning cash because they're funding the growing ambition to become a global content powerhouse. Mm. To get new subscribers, you have to provide new content. To have new content, you have to fund production, and so on. It's so far growing, but not profitable. And they claim they will be possibly free cash flow positive by before around 2022, effectively. Right. So you have to pay a triple digits PE again for this for this jewel. But there is a possibility they really become the dominant global player in content, and you can see from what's happening around in media, Disney, Comcast, Fox, all this M&A happening because they all understand that this is the enemy, and so they are trying to put together similarly large businesses to fight the advance of Netflix. Mm-hmm. And that's for the FANG.
That's a beautiful summary. Thank you so much. And I think it's really important for investors to understand. You know, they're quite different businesses in terms of size anyway, and in terms of the amount you pay for the privilege of accessing their growth. You know, quite mature businesses in the case of Facebook, for example. It's hard to get dramatic growth when you've already got 2.2 billion users.
Yes, correct. Saturation is an issue at some point.
That will obviously happen eventually. Yeah. So it's powerful for people to understand they may be the acronym stocks, the ones that people think about, but there's so much more out there. So tech sector is not just social media and web-enabled businesses. How do you suggest investors break down the micro sectors within technology? So software, hardware, networks,
sure.
Gaming, you've talked about miniaturization and all of these different things. How do people start to process that?
Within the technology sector, we tend to identify a few major industries with specific characteristics. So, for example, software is a clear industry where you have within itself subdivisions like enterprise software, infrastructure software, software services. These are generally industries which are transitioning from the old business model of selling you a license in software for perpetual usage to now a subscription model where you pay a monthly fee to use the software. The most representative companies in this space, which also we own in the technology fund, is Microsoft, which everybody probably should be familiar with.
Yeah, if you don't know Microsoft, No, you're probably not listening to this podcast, let's be honest.
A similar area, I mean, going down the list of the different industries which we look at, we invest in, is the data processing. Think about companies involved in processing transactions on behalf of banks or on behalf of e-commerce businesses. Digital payments is an area which belongs to this data processing, and the most representative company in this space is PayPal, which many people have a membership of, and of course it's a holding of a technology fund. We like this business very much.
Yes. Yeah, it's one that's very familiar, and once you as a user become familiar with it, it's pretty nice.
Yeah, very convenient. Mm. In semiconductors, it's another area where we invest. And this is a large industry with a lot of sub-segments. You have memories, acronym like DRAM and NAND, which are maybe not familiar to the large public, but they are inside your phone. So if you have a phone, you have probably these components inside an iPhone, DRAMs and NAND. Logic semiconductors also. And then semiconductor equipment manufacturing companies, which make the tools to produce these semiconductors. The most representative stock, again, in this industry is Intel, which has been powering PC for more than a decade, I would say, and it's an holding of the technology fund as well. Then there is a variety of components which go under the umbrella of electronic components. Mm. They include things like displays for smartphones, displays for TVs, or solar panels, or batteries for electric vehicles, things like capacitors for regulating the current in electricity current in your battery or in your electric vehicles. And this class of companies generally tend to be quite globally distributed. So we have a lot of Asian companies here, we have a lot of Koreans, a lot of Taiwanese, and we have a lot of names in this space, which are very interesting because are the providing, if you want, the components to a big in the technology revolution happening, as I mentioned earlier. A large industry is also hardware and telecom equipment, which is your typical PC, your server, or your telecom equipment for the Telstra to run the networks. And a name which could be familiar to with the public is Cisco Systems, a darling of the last decade, but still a very strong company and growing quite nicely. And then lastly, I would put gaming, entertainment, and media in a separate class. Mm-hmm. This obviously includes all the gaming devices from the Nintendo, the Xbox, the entertainment, which could be the Netflix we mentioned earlier, or the more traditional companies in the media space like Disney and Comcast. And these are more consumer-facing businesses, if you want. So each industry, the industries I listed earlier, is driven by specific trends, by technology evolution, by cyclical and structural factors, by competitive dynamics and different market forces. The major technology changes happen, disruptions happen periodically within each industry, and they often tend to trigger a domino-like effect across the various value chains. The trick for us as analysts and PMs at Platinum is to understand these changes and to assess at any point in time if the market is temporarily mispricing a stock in relation to what's happening. So if there is a gap between the price and what we think is the underlying intrinsic valuation, we can act accordingly. If we think it's cheap, we buy. If it's too expensive, we avoid it, or we can short sell the stock as well.
The ability to short sell is interesting, but given valuations, it's an interesting one.
Yes.
So you've alluded to something, but I do want to dig into this. So most investors, retail investors anyway, tend to think US and particularly Silicon Valley when they think high growth tech companies. And it's become almost folklore now, right? These incredibly elaborate stories about the founders and the high growth, and you know, it's amazing some of the stuff you read. It really goes back to the sort of the titans of the earlier 20th century in the US, and you know how they really glorify their business leaders and so on. And yet the US is clearly not everything in this space. All of the component parts are coming from around the world and so on. What are your thoughts about how we view it?
Yeah, it's interesting because I agree with you. The US, for economic reason, is home to the vast majority of technology companies for a number of reasons. There is the depth of university research, the large funding from the US government, including the Department of Defense. But you're right, the supply chain these days is global, so these US companies may have a lot of businesses actually outside of the US, or the Apple iPhone is manufactured in China, for example. But when we look at the markets and investment generally, you consider, for example, the global technology benchmark, such as the MSCI IT index. Obviously, this is there is an overwhelming weight of U.S. stocks in this index. 72% of the index is made of U.S. stocks. And the top four stocks alone, just that's amazing, Apple, Alphabet, Microsoft, and Facebook, make more than 30% of the index. So if you buy an ETF tracking this index, you basically are very much U.S. And top four accounting for 30% of the index. We tend to have a more diversified approach at Platinum, so we do not track the benchmark at all, but invest in individual stocks on the basis of the individual merits. So it's not unusual for us to have a significant position outside of the US. Still, the US is 40% probably of the technology fund in terms of weighting. But take South Korea, for example. We have a few important investments in South Korea. We have a combined position of about 6.5% in Samsung Electronics and other names. Or take Greater China, which includes China, Hong Kong, and Taiwan. There we have about 16% of a fund. Or even if you venture into Europe in individual countries, we may like a semiconductor company in Austria, let's say, which we found a little jewel a couple of years ago. And we have a 2 or 3% position in an Austrian company. Or in Norway, where we have invested in a publishing e-commerce company in Norway, and so on. So we are fairly geographically agnostic. Technology supply chains, as I said, these days are global, are well integrated, so it doesn't matter really where you are, it matters what you do at the end of the day.
I think that's an excellent point. It's kind of easy to get a bit carried away with the hype about the NASDAQ and the stuff in the US and Silicon Valley and the stories about the founders and those sorts of things without understanding that, or without looking a little bit deeper and seeing that there's a whole lot of companies doing very core activity to ensure the success of the bigger brands.
I mean, the founders are important, as you said. I mean, Steve Jobs, I mean, importance to Apple, nobody can deny it. But funny enough, the phone is made in China. So.
Yeah, there are plenty of other people involved. It wasn't just one person. It's a lot of our investors are starting to look really closely at the rise of technology in China and the opportunity in that market. Such an enormous population. Obviously, people have been enthusiastically following the urbanization of that population and the rise of the middle class. And part of that is their access to technology, which is growing so rapidly, notwithstanding issues around tariffs and IP, which is a bit of an issue as well. But should we or should our investors be concerned about some of the governance and geopolitical issues with the rise of Asia and China in this sector? Or do you think, given that manufacturing is global, you need to keep them in the mix?
You're spot on. This is a really today's question. It's on everybody's mind and on the newspapers every day. So Asian tech stocks, China, Korea, Taiwan, have grown enormously over the last decade. We have positions at Platinum in major e-commerce, social networks, gaming companies in China, and find the long-term potential very attractive. I mean, they're not going to go away, but you're right. There is a problem at the moment, especially with the US debate about IP, debate about tariff and unfair competition. So let's make a step back. In terms of governance, I mean, I'm not sure if you're referring to the sort of loose governance in some countries compared to others. We don't think that China is particularly different from any other countries. We have been witnessing the dot-com bust in the US, where we had a lot of frauds coming out, the Enron, the Tyco, the MSCI WorldCom disaster. So corporate governance is important everywhere. And it's also, it was always a good idea to make a proper due diligence and pay attention to individual company history, management, track record. South Korea, for example, has historically a bad corporate governance reputation, but they are getting better now slowly. In terms of a more of a broader issue between trade between China and the US and the global supply chain, this is really a very big question mark. Export bans, tariffs, if implemented fully, as threatened by Mr. Trump, they could ultimately be very damaging to all, including US technology companies,
everybody,
who tend to have large manufacturing operations based or outsourced in mainland China. You can't really reverse globalization. I think it's not really a good idea. It would end up in creating a huge recessions across many countries. But so where do we draw the line? I don't know. It's a question of understanding what is the ultimate US intention. It's a political objective they have. So they will go to a negotiating table eventually. Then they settle on something which is feasible for both parties. We think so, but with Trump, you tell me, what's the end, what's the end game?
Yeah, you'll find out from one of the tweets, I imagine, at some point.
Yeah.
It's a complex question. Mm. Back to the US, so, and you certainly alluded to this right at the beginning, the valuations are like nosebleed high in some cases. It's
yes.
astonishing when you're paying over 100 times for yes. something. Where do you go from here? It always astonishes me. I can be a little bit bearish about some of these sorts of things, and
yeah.
I think they're going to stop, and it doesn't happen.
Yes, you're right. Technology stocks in particular have outperformed the general market. If you take the last 5 years to June to 2018, the Standard & Poor's 500, the S&P 500 is up by nearly 90%, almost 90%. While the S&P IT index, a sub-index representing information technology, was up by 170%, so almost twice the Standard & Poor's 500. Mm. If we look at valuation parameters, if we take the price-to-sales ratio, for example, just to take a parameter which is not affected by different accounting on earnings and so on, the same sub-index, the S&P IT index, it has almost doubled, going from 2.5 times price to sales to around 5 times price to sales. So it's a doubling valuation. We take the valuation on the more traditional PE, forecast PE, for the same group of technology companies. It also has reached a level of 20 times, which was last achieved before the GFC. So maybe
that's
a warning.
That's
not very important.
Right.
So, and then even more worryingly, inside the tech stock indices performance, you can see that the performance has been driven by a narrow group of companies, probably the FANG and stuff like that. So they've been increasingly perceived as safe bets, and it does tell you the market is sort of running out of ideas, perhaps, of concentrating on the on something which is safer. Because in fact, if you take a look at the FANG, they are not involved in much of this Chinese war, because Chinese tariff wars, because it's not it's more domestic. It's global, but they're not in China anyway that much. I mean, Amazon is not in China, Google is not in China, Facebook is not in China. So they are sort of profiting from a different dynamics and different drivers. So it's not a coincidence that these stocks are doing very well when maybe the semiconductor stocks are suffering because of the China problems. So in terms of general risk for the tech stocks currently, the two big risks I see is the trade wars, as we mentioned, and second is the potential acceleration of monetary tightening from the Federal Reserve, because historically, when you have monetary tightening, interest rates go up and valuation tend to go down, I'm afraid. So that's
a risk. Not specific really just to this sector, they're risks for everybody.
Yes, in general, yeah.
So in this environment where valuations are pretty high, are there any areas that to you look undervalued, or is there any technology, this is the flip side of it, any technology that looks really exciting that could justify the high multiples?
In terms of stocks currently undervalued, we think the semiconductor companies in many instances have now reached a discount in terms of valuation to the general market.
Mm.
Maybe rightly so, but investors are worried that the cycle has extended for a longer than usual period and the slowdown is around the corner. So definitely any recession-induced slowdown will clearly have a negative impact on semiconductor stocks. But if you take a longer-term view, there is, however, beyond any short-term physiological slowdown, a secular trend for stronger demand for silicon as semiconductors. Driven by a lot of new applications emerging, such as artificial intelligence, Internet of Things, self-driving cars, and so on. All these applications, which now are just we're just seeing in very, very early stages, eventually will demand an enormous amount of semiconductor capacity, semiconductor production, and we think that some of the names in this space are actually potentially very attractive now, trading at very low low teens price earning in many instances, which is very much different from the triple digits numbers I mentioned earlier.
So that's a great insight, and I think a lot of our investors will be quite interested to hear that. Now, one question, you've been working with the technology fund since 2000, which was an extraordinary year to launch a technology fund and managing it since shortly after that. What have you learned?
Yeah, I learned many things. the year 2000, when I was covering technology stocks with Andrew Clifford, we actually launched the fund. And back then, I think we had a lot of shorts on the fund rather than longs. But we did very well, actually, relative to the market. But back then, the market had reached levels of extreme overvaluation to the point that now is being recognized as one of the greatest bubble ever, the internet bubble or the dot-com bubble, you choose your term. There was a combination of factors back then. There was the emergence of the internet as a new communication tool, first of all. We never heard about that before. There was the creation of new businesses disrupting traditional models completely. And on top of that, we had a strong U.S. economy fueled by loose monetary policy. So a combination of factors which helped the U.S. market and technology stocks in particular to reach stratospheric valuations. So what did I learn then? I would say two things. First, valuations cannot expand forever. Ultimately, they have to be backed up by underlying growth and tangible profitabilities. New paradigms, new valuation parameters such as eyeballs, dollars per eyeballs, and so on, can only be accepted if profitability ultimately is part of the equation. And the second thing I learned is that tech companies live fast and die young.
That's great.
Technology is a difficult segment to invest in. Companies often have limited financial history. They operate in new industries with products and services constantly changing. Technology keeps evolving, and with evolution changes the leadership of the stock market. The champions of the past can easily be disrupted by the new company in town. So yesterday's heroes can become tomorrow's villains. So do we remember what happened to the likes of Research in Motion, the BlackBerry company, or Nokia, or Compaq, or to mention one of your favorite names, Kodak?
Yeah, yeah.
They do not always fail, these companies, but they often fade or get taken over, absorbed by larger entities. So the most important message in technology investing is probably, from my point of view, is keep on top of changes and do not extrapolate from the past.
That's really powerful. Write that down. Alex, Platinum publishes a number of thoughtful and provocative papers. So you do white papers that are very insightful on many different industries and different topics. How can people keep up to date with the sorts of investment ideas that you publish?
Well, you just go back to our website, definitely. Mm-hmm. You subscribe to our quarterly report, which actually summarizes a lot of this insight in our individual funds. And otherwise, just give us a call.
Yes. Beautiful. Alex, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you, Gemma.
As always, thank you so much for listening to this episode of Your Wealth. We hope, as always, it's helpful to you as you build and invest your wealth. We always love to hear from you, like Alex. So if you have any feedback or suggestions for future topics, please just email us at yourwealth@nab.com.au. I'm Gemma Dale. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for listening to Your Wealth with Gemma Dale. To stay up to date, please subscribe to this podcast series or email us at yourwealth@nab.com.au.
Please note that any advice provided in this podcast has been prepared without taking into account your objectives, financial circumstances, or needs. Before acting, you should consider the appropriateness of the information. To find out more, please visit nab.com.au.